This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ah, just like the good old days, Timothy Geithner and the financial crisis are back in the news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 7th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. We will note in passing as we get going today that Wall Street got hammered, positively walloped, on fears of slowing global economic growth. Bad though they were, the losses today were a far cry from the depths of the financial crisis, which, as it happens, was on trial today in a Washington, D.C. courtroom. AIG's former CEO, you remember AIG, yes, the big insurance company bailed out to the tune of $85 billion. The company's former CEO is saying that the terms of the bailout were unfair and that, in fact, the government owes AIG money. Former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was on the witness stand today, and Sally Herships reports what this case uncovers could change the narrative of a big part of the crisis.
Lawsuits are all about getting to the bottom of things.
Well, there have been a lot of studies of the financial crisis, but do we really know what happened?
James Angel says not really. He teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. He says this lawsuit could reveal new details about the financial crisis, the facts we don't know, and the Watergate question, what the Fed knew and when it knew it. Sounds exciting, but John Coffey, director of Columbia Law School's Center on Corporate Governance, isn't so sure.
I don't think you're going to learn dramatically new information. You may hear snippets, emails, anecdotes that support both sides.
Coffey says there are two opposing points of view on how the government handled AIG's bailout.
One side said it was done to prevent financial contagion and panic. The other side says it was done to achieve a backdoor bailout of large banks that you wouldn't have dared fund directly and publicly.
Coffey's opinion, the court won't decide to oversee or restrain financial regulators. He says those new regulations already exist, thanks to Dodd-Frank. But Georgetown's Angel disagrees.
If the evidence that comes out in the case shows that there was a big misfire at the Fed, then Congress may react and change the way the Fed operates.
Angel says public reaction to government bailouts was so negative that when Congress passed Dodd-Frank, it reduced the Fed's ability to act. And new restrictions could be key in a future crisis. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Like, oh, I don't know, everything else these days, education runs on data. Big data. Our kids' data. Every digital move that students make in school, on homework websites and apps, is tracked. And it's not always clear where that information is going or how companies are using it. Parents want better protections. The multi-billion-dollar education technology industry wants to keep on growing. So today, some big-name ed tech providers announced a voluntary privacy pledge. From Learning Curve, that's our project on education and technology. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at just how far the pledge goes and how far it doesn't.
The voluntary pledge says edtech companies won't sell a kid's data. They won't use it to target specific ads to specific kids. Mark Schneiderman is with the Software and Information Industry Association, which represents the $8 billion edtech industry.
We are aware that policymakers and education leaders and parents are looking at this issue, and this is an industry effort to show that industry is aware of those questions.
part of the industry anyway. Microsoft, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, Amplify, and several other companies have signed the voluntary pledge. Notably absent, classroom giants like Google, Apple, and Pearson. Bill Bowman is the VP of Information Security for Houghton Mifflin.
Thankfully for Houghton Mifflin, we've been 100% in alignment with the pledge and all the different elements that are inside of the pledge document.
Same story for Amplify and the rest of the pledgees. They're already doing all these things. So what's the point?
You could look at it glass half full, glass half empty.
Joni Lupovitz is with the advocacy group Common Sense Media. She says it's good for an industry to adopt a list of best practices. It might pressure ed tech companies that aren't protecting student data to do more. But the glass half empty bit?
It's a private pledge. It doesn't have the same teeth or the same enforcement
of, say, a law, like the tough one signed in California last week that limits what ed tech companies can do with student data. Lupovitz says the industry needs the trust of parents and teachers. It's the only way to keep the booming industry booming and bring the real promise of tech to the classroom. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We've got kind of a crazy infographic on our website that looks at all the ways that data is scraped off of our kids. And believe you me, there are a whole lot of ways. It's marketplace.org/learningcurve. On Wall Street today, yeah, just go ahead and cue up the wah-wah trombones, you guys in the control room, all right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So there you are, snug on your couch, streaming your favorite TV show online, and you all of a sudden notice the same couple of ads are repeating over and over and over again every commercial break. Yes, that does sometimes happen on regular TV, but not like this. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson went to find out why.
Let's curl up with some back episodes of Scandal, ABC's rather addictive show about crisis manager Olivia Pope. She often works for and is in love with the president of the United States. There's some high drama with his kids right before a big live interview when we pause for a commercial break.
Larry chooses to trade with Merrill Edge.
At first, I barely noticed Larry, but he keeps popping up in almost every commercial break across 3.5 episodes. No judgment, please.
How did we get like this?
So by the time Olivia Pope starts questioning her life and choices in the season finale, I'm wondering how I could be so annoyed with Larry and his purple V-neck sweater and his love of Merrill's simple pricing structure.
Larry chooses to trade with Merrill Edge. Larry chooses to Larry.
Yeah, that's a very common experience these days.
Jim Nail is an analyst with Forrester Research.
That when you're watching television programs that are streamed either from the network streaming app or some other service, that you see the same ads over and over and over again.
Nail says all this repetition could risk annoying the consumers companies are trying to woo. Part of the problem is that advertisers haven't caught up with the way we binge watch shows online. Seeing Larry a few times in one episode, no big deal. But string a few together, and he gets grating.
Larry chooses to trade with Merrill Edge.
But a bigger reason for all the repetition? Nail says there's still a shortage of online advertisers, because we don't have the same kind of data about digital audiences that we do for television. So even though video advertising revenue increased 20% in 2013, many advertisers are holding back.
There aren't enough advertisers comfortable buying to follow the model of broadcast television, which is, you know, 17 minutes of commercials an hour, which means 34 advertisers, give or take.
So in an online show, you might have only a handful of advertisers, which makes a lot more work for Internet Larry than his TV peers. But even Larry has his standards. He probably doesn't want to be next to someone's shaky homemade YouTube videos. Sure, there's tons of content online these days, but Anna Baker with the Interactive Advertising Bureau says the amount advertisers actually want to buy is still relatively small.
The inventory is scarce, so advertisers tend to want to buy all of the inventory.
And Baker thinks there's another reason for some of the repetition. Advertisers want to make sure their message gets through to you while you're checking your email, clicking around the internet, or whatever else you might do to avoid Larry.
Advertising is usually annoying. I think we kind of know that. We may be incredibly annoyed with Progressive because their ad keeps showing up and it's kind of an annoying ad in general.
Making sure you get a great deal. Now that's Progressive. Call or click today.
But when we want to buy insurance, we know that Progressive is an insurance company.
Larry chooses to trade with Merrill Edge.
And we all now know that Merrill Edge is an investment account. We may well remember that if we're ever in the market for something similar. But I might also remember my grudge against Larry and decide to go with one of his competitors instead. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got a whole series we're doing about exactly this kind of thing, the future of television. It's called Screen Wars, and it lives on our website, marketplace.org. The latest J.P. Morgan data breach was a biggie. 76 million households, 7 million small businesses. And because it's a public company, J.P. Morgan was required by law to tell federal regulators about anything that could affect its share price, which this conceivably could, and that is what it did. They notified the SEC last Thursday. Other companies, however, don't have such strict disclosure requirements. And in fact, when it comes to data breaches in this country, there is at best a confusing patchwork of laws. From Washington Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
It may surprise you there's no overarching federal law. Fred Cate heads the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University.
From the very beginning of sort of digital technologies and the internet, the federal government took the view of keep its hands off.
So the state stepped in. California was the first to pass what's called a data breach notification law. It's been on the books there since 2003. And 46 states followed, along with Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. Each one has a different law with different requirements.
I think everyone assumed that once you got a bunch of conflicting state laws, Congress would step in and provide some clarity by providing a single federal law.
But that has not happened. Proposals have been held up in Congress, and an executive order President Obama signed last year is voluntary. The reason why there's no federal statute?
I could make a lot of money if I knew the answer to that question, why there isn't.
Tina Iotis teaches cybersecurity at George Washington University. She says we're starting to see breach fatigue. There's been a string of high-profile hacks at Home Depot and Target, and now at J.P. Morgan.
At this point, the pain is not enough to really make it so that it becomes a priority.
What could change that, says Seton Hall law professor David Opterbeck, is a cyber attack on infrastructure.
Like a power grid or a water supply or the market shut down for a few days. When that kind of thing happens, then maybe we'll see some action.
But until then, the action continues to be at the state level, keeping lawyers, consultants, and compliance officers busy and consumers confused. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
It's been almost 25 years since Twin Peaks, David Lynch's strange and violent series set in a small town in the Pacific Northwest. It lasted only two seasons in the original, but the word cult following does kind of apply here. And that helps explain why Showtime says it's going to produce season three. Creators David Lynch and Mark Frost will pick up the storyline 25 years on. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
After Twin Peaks ended, Lynch followed it up with the feature film Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. The opening credits appear in front of television static until someone smashes the TV with an axe.
And some people took that as David Lynch saying, never, never, I'm never going back to TV.
Greil Marcus is a critic who wrote about Twin Peaks. And back in 1991, the television industry that Lynch worked in was a wildly different landscape than today.
People would look you straight in the eye and say, well, I don't watch television. You know, and that was supposed to be a shorthand for I'm too smart to watch television.
Twin Peaks helped change that, says LA Times critic Mary McNamara. Lynch was a highly regarded filmmaker, and the huge audience he attracted, it watched TV in a new way.
When Twin Peaks originally aired, it created, in a lot of respects, the concept of watching a television show closely and analyzing it for clues.
Liz Shannon Miller is a TV editor at IndieWire.com. She says because Twin Peaks was available on Netflix, it found a new audience with young people. That makes a revival more attractive to studios. And Twin Peaks had planted a seed.
You know, a show like True Detective would obviously never exist without David Lynch moving into television.
Marcus says because it's airing on Showtime, Lynch is free from many of the constraints he faced in the 90s. Showtime says it's giving Lynch and co-creator Mark Frost carte blanche. That seed that Lynch planted has grown into a Lynchian forest of new TV shows with dark themes and mysteries that aren't always revealed. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up...
You know, like it or not, the celebrity halo is something that really works.
Which explains why you've got a pair of pants with Jessica Simpson's name or Kanye's name on them. But first, let's do the numbers. There they are. Although, just for the record, I do not control the music around here. We should all just know that. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 272 points today, 1.6%, 16,719. The NASDAQ gave that 69 points, 1.5%, finished at 4,385. The S&P 500 down 29 points, also 1.5%, ended things at 1,935. Every single component of the Dow was down, by the by, save one. Coca-Cola was the only green. Our shares up almost 0.75%. The Container Store, you know, the company that sells containers and all manner of storage devices. The Container Store Group said it had lower than expected sales last quarter, cut its sales forecast for the year. Shares off 24%. Find a box for that, huh? You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Nobel season continues with the announcement for the prize in chemistry. Stocking up on household stuff for the long winter? Costco hopes so. It releases quarterly earnings. And promoting safety and healthy habits. Tomorrow is International Walk to School Day. Your performance will be recorded on your permanent record. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. We're back. Worries about slowing economic growth from the International Monetary Fund this morning did a number on energy prices. Fears of lower demand kept crude oil down below $89 a barrel. We live, as we are all completely aware, in a society and an economy dominated by fossil fuels. And despite our best, all right, despite our modest efforts, it's been really hard to switch to something else. One big reason for that is that oil packs a whole lot of energy in a tiny little package, which helps us understand a little bit of how crude became king over time. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
In the last four centuries, we human beings have gone through several so-called energy transitions, and each step up has involved a superior product in terms of energy density. In other words, concentrated energy in smaller and smaller packages. So let's zoom through a bit of time. Starting in 17th century Holland, the Dutch burned something called peat, which is moss, very dead moss. And peat played a big role in human development, says historian John McNeil at Georgetown University.
They burned it in energy-intensive industries, beer brewing, glass making, sugar refining.
Peat, though, doesn't burn as long or as hot as what came later, coal. So in the late 18th and the 19th century, coal-powered steam engines took ships and trains farther. Coal also brought new industrial possibilities, like turning iron ore into steel.
Coal has an energy density, a couple of multiples of wood, charcoal, peat. You can't, for example, do metallurgical work with a peat flame. You can't get it hot enough. Coal, you can.
And then we found oil. And once again, the new fuel offered a more dense energy payload. And ever since, oil-based gasoline and diesel and jet fuel have dominated our energy lives. Now, because of carbon pollution, of course, some drivers now are driving on electric batteries, which by energy density is an inferior product. But history tells us that technology doesn't always equal destiny. Let's go back to 1900. This is America's longest-running antique car show. This is the Old Car Festival at the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan. And here there's a 1902 car that runs on steam. There are plenty of gas cars from that era. And a 1902 electric car. They go back that far, and they're so quiet you can't even hear them over the noise. So why did EVs lose out back a century ago? Well, it's not exactly what you think. Curator Matt Anderson at the Ford Museum says electrics, how do I put this, they weren't manly enough for the times.
Electrics were thought to be the ideal women's car, if you will. You don't have to crank it, so it doesn't require as much physical strength to get it running and operating. They're much cleaner than a gasoline automobile. They don't emit the kind of fumes or exhaust that we associate with those cars.
All of which sounds great, except consumers back then, they didn't want that. They wanted a messy adventure machine.
It made noise. It broke down.
David Kirsch is an automotive historian at the University of Maryland.
It was relatively easy to fix, so a man could take his girlfriend out into the woods and do what they will. And if he were very lucky, the vehicle might break in a way that he could fix it.
And thus display his masculinity. Kirsch's point is that culture is an important wild card in technology history. It was back then and could be going forward in ways we can't predict. Today, with car sharing, Ubering, Zipcaring, and more automated driving, the nature of travel is slowly changing. And, like a century ago, new people are placing new bets on rival fuels. And energy density may not necessarily be the deciding factor this time. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's a given of behavioral economics that people are willing to pay more for a piece of clothing or a pair of shoes if it has the right label inside, if it's made by a certain high-end designer who is hot right now. Turns out they'll do the same thing if that shoe or shirt has the right celebrity name on it, a phenomenon that is increasingly common, those celebrity labels. Terry Agins writes for The Wall Street Journal. She is also the author of a new book about celebs and fashion called Hijacking the Runway. Terry, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Kai.
So this is, we should say, not all about how celebrities endorse various, you know, pairs of jeans or sneakers or shirts or whatever it is, right? It's celebrities having their own fashion lines.
Well, celebrities, as we know, were always billboards for designers. What's happened, what the news is now celebrities have actually taken over, and they actually now have their own brands. And this is something that, so they're actually competing with designers.
Far be it for me to judge, but what does, just to pick the first example in your book, Jessica Simpson, or, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow, or anybody know about fashion?
Well, they know a lot about fashion, Kai, because remember, I mean, they're wearing it on the red carpet. I mean, with the
yeah, but I wear Levi's every day, and I'm not there designing Levi's.
No, but if you're a celebrity, this is a great way for you to monetize your brand.
Aha, there you go.
The $20 million paydays that, you know, actresses like Cameron Diaz had, those days are over.
And you mean for movies, right?
Yes, for movies, exactly. And for them to actually, you have a lot of people who are famous, but who don't make a lot of money. So for a lot of celebrities, they're saying, wow. In addition to just being, you know, a billboard, I can, you know, do my own brand and, you know, bring in some revenue and also, you know, add to my notoriety.
It is a mistake to think that Jessica Simpson or Cameron Diaz or anybody are actually designing their own clothes, right? They're not sitting there at a drafting table, you know, doing the A-line skirt and all this stuff.
Well, there is, I mean, I'll put it like this. A celebrity line really connects when it looks like something that they would wear. So obviously, the design team uses that celebrity and looks at the way that they dress and their persona, and they try to translate in that into clothes. But remember, even in any kind of modern fashion house, there is a whole platoon of people to help, you know, bring these collections out because it takes a village.
And we should say, I mean, I picked on Jessica Simpson, but it's not just women, right? I mean, there's Kanye and Sean Combs and all this.
Oh, yeah. Well, Shaquille O'Neal now has a,
I no, mean, since I wrote really? The book.
Yeah, he's got a suit line.
Seriously? And then, for normal size people?
No, he's actually big and tall.
Oh, man.
He's big and tall. And then Donald Trump, you know, right after The Apprentice. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Donald Trump has a suit line at Macy's, which is, you know, a really top seller. And, of course, not to mention Michael Jordan. Huh. And so this is a really a big deal.
We totally need a public radio fashion line, but I guess that's a whole different interview. How do actual designers think of this whole celebrity trend? Are they scared? Do they care? Do they look down their noses?
Well, it's a combination of things. A lot of them are jealous too, because when you see the size, you know, of a Jessica Simpson business, because remember, I wrote my very first story in 2005 for the Wall Street Journal when she launched a jeans line in Los Angeles. And, you know, we thought that this was just going to be a kind of a one-off. The jeans line actually didn't do that well. But, you know, she went back and got a really good backer, Vince Camuto, who is one of the former founders of Nine West, a really expert shoe guy. And he relaunched her and turned her into a billion-dollar business in less than 10 years in 22 product categories.
Well, I mean, are they going after different slices of the market, or are they all competing for the same people, right? Are actual fashion houses designing for one set and celebrities designing for another?
Oh, no. There's a lot of overlap. Everyone is basically feeding from the same trough because, remember, everyone's wardrobe is a mixture of high and low clothes. The same person who wears, you know, Gucci and Prada also has Uniqlo or even something from Target. And so we're all doing a high-low mix. So we need a reason to get excited and to buy something. And, you know, like it or not, the celebrity halo is something that really works. I mean, look, last week in Paris, the Kardashians basically took over Paris. I mean, the Kardashians, no one remembers, you know, what was on the runways at Chanel or Lanvin. We all just remember Kimye and the little daughter sitting on the, you know, on the front row of all these shows.
Once we're talking about Kimye on Marketplace, we're done. The book is called Hijacking the Runway by Terry Agins. Terry, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is offered without comment, GM, General Motors, issued another recall this morning. It's seventh since Thursday. This one was for a bad transmission in about 7,600 Chevy Caprice police cars. In total, reports the Wall Street Journal, GM has issued 75 recalls this year alone, more than 30 million cars in total. No recalls today at Marketplace. The only place you could have a recall, though, would be on Wall Street. The Dow off 272 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ down 69 points. The S&P 500 off 29 points, 1.5%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.